a pleasure to be here. Sorry that I missed the rest of the meeting earlier this week. I was reviewing grants at NIH. Couldn't get out of that, unfortunately. I'm going to talk about some of our work in trying to leverage medical image data, include simulation techniques, and get a little more insight into mechanisms of disease and also tools for predicting outcomes of interventions. And I think we've seen some examples of this so far, but really the extraordinary quality of medical image data. We really are at the point from an anatomic perspective where we can get, you know, do full body scans, for instance, CT scans with sub-millimeter resolution. I think we're starting to see small structures. These are small intercostal arteries. This is actually an image of my aorta from actually about 10 years ago, and the image quality has even improved. I'm not sure I've improved over the 10 years, but the image quality has certainly improved. These are all examples from CT imaging. This is actually an interesting case of an axillary femoral bypass. So bypass from the axillary artery all the way down into the pelvis provide blood supply for the patient who has really extensive aortoiliac disease. This is a carotid example and then a case of lower extremity disease. So anatomic imaging data is really progressing at a phenomenally fast pace. Most recently, we've had techniques to image dynamic anatomy, for instance, cardiac aided CT images. This is a cardiac aided CT image that we acquired of a patient with a thoracic stent graft. And it's quite interesting as this rotates around. You see the heart beating, but it'll actually, as it rotates around and we pan through the volume, you can actually image and resolve motion of devices, deformation of devices. We're using this to be able to understand dynamics of devices implanted in the circulation to be able to ultimately help device manufacturers develop better tests. Based upon real in vivo conditions, in order to develop devices that are more durable. This is dynamic image data. So, the limitation of medical imaging is that we get exquisite anatomic data, we get very little information on flow. We can observe disease, but we have to rely on empirical data from other people in order to predict how it will progress, and observe and monitor devices, but we can't actually measure forces acting on them. We can measure motion, but we can't get force information. And we can observe the effect of a given therapy on the health of the patient, but we can't predict the best treatment a priori. And this type of information, knowledge of flow and pressure, is important for many parts. I mean, I think we are not surprised by that fact, but if you think about clinical medicine right now, there's all of this data, anatomic data, but nothing's flowing through the arteries. It's just static images of geometry, not information about function. So for instance, if this is a patient with a triple bypass graft, the knowledge of how that patient's coronary circulation will improve with that procedure is quite important, ultimately, to the outcome for this patient. This is an example of how flow and pressure forces influence device design. This is a stent graft implanted in a patient's abdominal aortic aneurysm, and this is post-implantation a year and then 3 years later. You actually see how the stent graft has migrated, has been forced, the repetitive pulsatile forces pushing the stent graft down into the aneurysm. This patient the device is still isolating the aneurysm from pressure, but that might not be the case for long. So again, these are forces that are acting on devices that knowledge of which we certainly need. But in medicine is a diagnostic empirical paradigm. And it says an example of the very same procedure when done correctly. So this is what happens. This is the honest to God truth. What happens is that, of course, you see the patient with the sheet over his head wheeled out and the new patient wheeled in. The point is that, doing experimentation, using this approach where you find out what's going to happen for the patient after you've done the procedure, is a paradigm that I think is ripe for change. So what we've tried to do is to develop techniques, and hopefully I'm going to not have trouble with my movies, for image-based modeling. And these are some of the first models that we created, actually right about the time that we started getting CT data, spiral CT data at Stanford. This is late 95, early 96. Realized that maybe we could actually start to build geometry from this and do simulations of blood flow in the arterial tree. We've developed different tools for predictive medicine, you know, breaking from the diagnostic empirical paradigm into one which is really fundamentally based on prediction. A first software system called Advanced Surgical Planning Interactive Research Environment, and we had a panel of four presidents of the Society for Vascular Surgery run it live. And this was, you see, this back in the day when everybody's using the SGI workstations. These are the Octane workstations that were running the software that they were using live. So I want to talk about basically what we've been doing for the last 12 years or so since we started working on some of these ideas. And of course, the problem is always more challenging once you get into it than it appears maybe at first blush. But some of the challenges are really going from image data to geometry, and there's different techniques. We saw some very nice examples of a direct 3D approach, and I'll talk about that again in a second. But another approach that we've used is a technique where we basically use a medial thinning algorithm to be able to find a centerline path, then 2D level set segmentations along the vessel boundary to identify the contours of the vessel, loft, NURB surfaces, solid models, and then discretize from there. And the advantage of this approach is you can create, you know, very complex geometry in many cases. For instance, from the aortic arch into the circle of Willis, descending thoracic aorta with all of mapping out all of the intercostal arteries for this patient. And, for instance, a model from the neck down to the toes. And these are, it's quite tedious, I have to confess, to create these models using this approach. But in some cases, there really is a need for operator intervention. And the direct 3D approaches, which we also use, are incredibly powerful and fast, but sometimes don't give us enough user intervention to account for difficulties in quality of medical image data. But we are developing these techniques as well. And here's an aneurysm with a 3D level set segmentation and then a direct mesh created from that. And here's subject with a cerebral aneurysm imaged at four-year intervals. This is an inoperable cerebral aneurysm because it's right at the bifurcation, and very interesting changes in morphology that we're trying to understand. Actually, what you see is that looks like it's getting smaller at that time. The aneurysm, trust me, is not getting smaller, but it's probably getting filled in with clot. So what you actually image, the lumen boundary, is smaller. It's less common to find clots in cerebral aneurysms and abdominal aortic aneurysms, but sometimes that can happen. So we're interested in understanding the changes in fluid dynamics that might influence clot growth. So discretization. So when we go from geometry construction, then the next challenge we face is discretization. And one of the approaches that we've taken is to try to use adaptive mesh refinement, specifically using anisotropic mesh generation so that we can stretch elements in the direction of the vasculature, because what you see is that typically the very slowly changing fields down the length of the vessel and more rapidly changing fields in the radial direction for many problems, not for all. In some cases where you have very complex flow, you need more of an isotropic mesh, but we've developed techniques to do that. And then parallel computing algorithms to be able to ultimately prove mesh independence in some problems often requires we push up to 10 or to tens of millions of elements. One of the biggest challenges, and this has been touched on so far, and give a very nice overview of this, is the issue about realistic outflow boundary conditions. And the challenge is that we have billions of vessels in our circulation. Most of them are beyond the limits of our image resolution. So if our goal is to do patient-specific modeling, we can image a part, a very small part of the vascular system. Often it's the part where we have, you know, many of the diseases like atherosclerosis and aneurysms that we're concerned about. But many of the vessels are beyond the limits of our image resolution. And just to illustrate this point, this is a mouse pulmonary tree imaged with micro CT down to a resolution of 10 microns. And you see, this is all still precapillary vessels. And this is a study that we did in rat pulmonary arteries where we did casting and then imaging with CT, and then we're doing morphologic analysis down to 12 micron resolution. So in us, in humans, we image a very small part of the circulation, and we have to rely upon other information, usually generic data collected over large groups of individuals. So one of the issues is how do we incorporate this type of downstream boundary condition information, the patient-specific models with the simplified models of downstream vessels that are not patient-specific. And I'll just talk a little bit about this. So the approach that we've taken is what we call a coupled multi-domain method, and we've tried to develop general strategies for coupling different generally reduced order models to outflow primarily, but in some cases inflow of numerical domains. This approach was inspired by the work that was done in the Dirichlet-Neumann maps. Actually, when I was a grad student at Stanford, I had the privilege of having quite a few conversations with Joe Keller, who was working on, who had done quite a bit of work in, together with Dan Gavoli, in boundary conditions for exterior acoustics problems. And I realized that maybe there was something that might be very close to the type of problem that we're interested in, where we have a numerical domain of interest. It's a little different because our downstream domain, it's not the same equation. We're using a reduced order model in the downstream domain. But the idea of being able to pose a problem like a Dirichlet-Neumann map and ultimately derive operators that include an analytic model of the downstream domain and incorporate that in a strong fashion into our numerical method. A lot of that derived from some of those ideas. So in essence, what we have to do is come up with operators that represent the downstream domain. And then these are just the changes in the momentum residual and the continuity residual for the fine element method that we're using. And this is a stabilized fine element method, and there's a lot of detail hidden behind the stabilization terms there. So again, the point is that if you have a different analytic model of the downstream domain, then you get a different operator that is then inserted into the three-dimensional domain. So for a very simple problem like steady flow, or in where you pose a Poisson flow in the analytic domain, you just recover this type of resistance boundary condition from that, and these are the two operators, the momentum and continuity operators. For a more complex problem like a Wind-Kessel model, a lump parameter model, then you have a more complex relationship in these operators. And this is, I'll show quite a few examples of this. It's no accident that I'm showing this on an abdominal aortic aneurysm model, because we often use this type of approach for many of our 3D simulations. And then one can also use linear wave propagation theory, calculate an impedance, and then this is the approach for incorporating those operators into the numerical domain to couple a 3D numerical solution to a analytic domain where we have linear wave propagation theory. We haven't really gone and tried to couple the 3D to 1D nonlinear models, and mostly I feel that a lot of the physics of at least what we're trying to get from our boundary conditions from the downstream domain can be captured pretty well with linear wave theory. And so with an impedance-based approach, you can generate a tree, a network of vessels using, for instance, data. In the case of there's a few organs where we have morphometric data, for instance, the pulmonary vasculature, and then we can generate a tree in some cases tens, you know, to hundreds of millions of vessels in the tree, recursively compute impedance of the tree in impedance function, and then this impedance function is then used at the outlet of our numerical domain and coupled in our boundary condition. So for this particular example, we're looking at a case of a child with tetralogy of Fallot with a stenosis in a pulmonary artery. The question was, what would be the benefit of removing the stenosis when this child was 16 years old? And the what we did in order to solve this is we created an image-based model of model for the vessels that we could see, and then once we got down to the limits of our image resolution from magnetic resonance angiography, we coupled a morphometric model. So we classified the vessel, and then we generated a morphometry-based model, recursively computed the impedance for that morphometry model, and then did the simulation on a large scale. What we learned from this, which is of interest, is that there was no difference with or without the stenosis. And the reason for this, I think it's actually quite clear, is that these types of patients usually have these obstructions from a very early age. And that stenosis affected the development of this lung. What you see is you see very few branches coming off the left side and a very really a well-developed right pulmonary tree. So it's the downstream resistance that is dominating and is much larger than the extra resistance due to the stenosis. These are the types of things that you can learn from this type of this approach. What about boundary conditions? Now, if we just take a very simple problem with an outlet boundary condition, we assign in constant outlet pressure, then the consequence of that, and this is actually a 3D fluid structure interaction simulation. I'll tell you about how we do that later. But constant outflow pressure, shown right here, the driving pressure required to get to drive a physiologic flow waveform is just a perturbation about that. And you see this type of ringing effect because of this artificial boundary condition. That's not what happens in a physiologic sense. We don't have a constant pressure at the end of an arterial tree. So I should say in this case, we prescribe inlet flow, and we have and we're looking at different boundary conditions. Likewise, the displacement, the wall dynamics, of course, is directly affected by the pressure. So if you don't get pressure right, you can't get wall dynamics right. So with an impedance boundary condition, then you get this inflow wave basically travels down. You don't see this type of ringing phenomena. And your inlet, this is the flow wave traveling down. You see your inlet pressure, which is in blue, in the dashed blue line is the outlet pressure, and you see that wave traveling down in about the right physiologic range, and you don't see any artificial reflection. So the point about boundary conditions is that what you want from a boundary condition is you want the wave to go down and then to basically encounter a boundary condition that is a representation of what's downstream. You don't want the wave to just leave and travel out through the domain and never come back. That's not the right boundary condition. You need the boundary condition here to reflect what that wave will encounter downstream. Clearly, if you think about an appropriate boundary condition, it's going to have to be, you're going to have to see some type of time history in your boundary condition. So when you look at the boundary conditions like the impedance function here, I mean, you clearly have a time history in your boundary condition and in your Wind-Kessel boundary condition as well, because it really is the waves that have left that boundary from a previous time that encounter the downstream vasculature and give you the right condition at a later time. So just a quick case study using this, looking at flow in the pulmonary arteries. And this is an example where we're interested in studying the pulmonary circulation for a number of reasons. One is a lot of congenital heart diseases affect the pulmonary circulation. So we're interested in just being able to describe complex flow conditions. Of note, the pulmonary arteries are really relatively unaffected by atherosclerosis, and it could be because of biochemistry. Blood pressure is a lot lower in the pulmonary circulation, but maybe also related to fluid dynamic conditions. So this is a model that we constructed from a normal subject from the main pulmonary artery down to about a 2 millimeter resolution vessel. And then we simulate flow actually under rest and then dynamic exercise conditions. And one of the things of note, and I was quite intrigued by this, is that you see the complexity of the flow and the secondary flows that are occurring quite far down in the circulation. And this, I think, has implications about our choices of models that we might want to look at for the downstream circulation.
So how do you deal with the boundary condition of the
ends of these? Every one of the outlets here, what we'll do is we'll classify based on size, classify the vessel, and then we'll generate a morphometry tree based upon that size. So we don't know, all we know, and I'll talk a little bit more about how we can then tune that to improve it. But in this case, this type of patient, all we know is we know roughly what blood pressure they're going to have in the pulmonary arteries. I mean, we can't measure it directly, but you could estimate what would be a normal level of blood pressure. So you know your driving pressure at the main pulmonary artery, and we were actually able to measure flow distribution between the two lungs. So we could adjust, you know, en masse, a group of boundary conditions on one side and another to be able to match the measured data.
At
every one of those outlets, we'll hook up a tree and compute an impedance recursively, compute an impedance that would be appropriate at that level of the pulmonary circulation.
It will be effective.
That's right. It'll be a terminal impedance or an input impedance of the tree downstream. Right. And then for the simulated exercise, we can then take that tree and dilate it, recompute the impedance function, and, you know, solve for flow. Yeah.
Okay, so which other primary
when you compare
from rest exercise.
Yeah,
so we in flow condition where we the input waveform is
okay.
different, and then the downstream condition
okay.
as well. And we typically with light levels of exercise in most parts of the circulation, you can accomplish light levels of exercise without much of a change in blood pressure.
Okay.
Oftentimes we'll based upon literature data, because that's will generally be all we have, we'll try to adjust the input flow waveform and the boundary conditions to be able to match, you know, as much information as we have from the patient, and then also literature data as to what would be normal. Yeah.
But the geometries are the same.
Geometries are the same between rest and exercise.
Maybe during the exercise we can expect then there is a buzzer or dilatation.
Well, maybe, but
okay.
probably not as much. There might be some in the large vessels. There definitely will be downstream, and that's accounted for by the change in boundary conditions. But there probably is some, but it's kind of beyond the level of what we can handle right now. So we were just interested in trying to, for different groups of subjects, understand even what the level of wall shear stress was. And what we saw with rest conditions, and this is, we have the proximal pulmonary artery around the right and left, right around the trunk, and then the more distal branches, and we can compute the level of shear stress and at rest and then exercise conditions. And one of the things that's significant here is that these levels of shear stress are about four times larger than the atherosclerosis prone abdominal aorta. So there is a difference in level of, we were talking about this point about what is a high or low shear stress. For the pulmonary, I would say this level of shear stress that we see is at the level above which you would typically see localization of atherosclerosis. It would be a high shear from an atherosclerosis localization perspective. Yeah.
You've commented a lot about the outflow condition. That's really interesting. What about the inflow? I mean, you're at least in that picture, the inflow is pretty close to that bifurcation.
Yeah, and in that case, in the inflow, we just have a constant, we measured the inflow with magnetic resonance, with phase contrast magnetic resonance imaging, the volumetric flow. But we didn't assign a profile based on the MR data. We assigned a flat profile. So that is a great question as to what the influence of the profile function might be. Yeah, so we'll have to look at that.
Okay.
Yeah. So let me talk now. Let's talk again a little bit more about boundary conditions. So very few organs of very few species have been characterized with different image data. I mean, Professor Zamir has done tremendous work in characterizing branching patterns of the arterial tree. But I think there's a need for a lot more of this type of data. We're using, so the issue is that how do we apply this? I mean, now if we have an abdominal aorta, where I'm pretty sure, I don't think that we have a branching pattern for all the different parts of the circulation that are downstream. What do? Under those circumstances? And we have geometry, but we can also measure different things. In the case of our abdominal aortic flow simulations, we can measure flow here with phase contrast MRI. We can measure the infrarenal flow. So the flow at the diaphragm is this blue curve, and the infrarenal aorta is this orange curve. And we note the reversal of flow in the infrarenal aorta. It's very classic for this type of this region of the vasculature, the triphasic flow, where you actually have flow reversal in early diastole, where blood, it goes down into the legs in systole, and then comes back up and out the renal arteries in early diastole. That's very characteristic of the abdominal aorta. So we have that data, and we can also perhaps make blood pressure measurements. We can measure, for instance, certainly brachial artery cuff pressure. There have been studies that have compared brachial artery pressure, systolic and diastolic, to blood pressure at the level of the diaphragm, and there's some evidence that they're very common or very, very similar. So we could have an approximation for pressure here. We have input flow, we have flow here. And we might have some idea about, under normal physiologic conditions, how flow would be redistributed. So the question is, how do we adjust our boundary conditions to be able to, you know, match the measured data that we do have, or to, you know, appropriately fit that measured data? So what we've been doing is basically, you know, developing, you know, strategies where, in some cases, we'll group the outlets, for instance, the outlets. You know, above the renal arteries and above, and the lower extremity vessels, and then derive objective functions, for instance, to try to match our maximum pressure, our minimum pressure, flow split. This is a parameter that basically tells us about a decay of the pressure wave, and other desired measured parameters, and then solve the, an optimization problem to basically tune the boundary conditions to match that measured available data. So, this is relatively short description of a pretty complex problem, and a student of my, one of my PhD students is just about to defend on this topic. But when we do this, we can take the supraceliac flow, which is measured, and then we can tune our simulation so that we can match the infrarenal flow waveform. Obviously, we can't specify that there, and absolutely, if we're doing a fluid structure interaction simulation, you're not going to be able to specify the outlet flows and get that desired flow at this level. Our aortic pressure wave is computed. We have targets for systolic and diastolic values, but then we compute the pressure at the level of the diaphragm, yellow, and you see this amplification, slight amplification of the pressure down at the level of the iliac arteries. I will point out, this is a fluid structure simulation, but it's with constant properties. The aorta actually has a stiffening. The properties get stiffer as you go more distally, and that will affect the pressure waves. But you know, we're basically trying to match with the available data, with the model that we're using, tune the simulations. So we have image-based data, image-based geometry. We have some physiologic measurements, and we're trying to put these together to be able to better fit that patient's condition. So just a quick case study, hemodynamics and aneurysms, abdominal aortic aneurysms is a clinical study that we're doing. I'll tell you about in a second. But some of the risk factors, age, smoking, Caucasian males are a higher risk. There's some familial history component. The cause of aneurysms is unknown. Certainly it's a destruction of the vessel wall. It's not a rise in pressure, it's a destruction of the vessel wall that ultimately results in aneurysms. But the study that we did is, first of all, it was an animal study where we induced aneurysms in the infrarenal aorta and then looked at the effect of flow. So what was fascinating here is that if you induce an aneurysm with basically isolate a segment of the aorta and infuse porcine pancreatic elastase and creates an inflammatory reaction that will result in aneurysm growth. And when we actually increased flow through the aorta, we got a slower growth of aneurysms. When we had reduced flow, we had a faster growth. And this is some of the data. So what we were able to show in an animal model is the amount of flow going through the aorta was influencing aneurysm growth. That was quite interesting. So here's an example of this in humans, where we look for a patient population that has very low flow down to their lower extremities. And those are actually patients with spinal cord injury. Because there's muscle atrophy, tissue atrophy, these patients end up with iliac arteries that look like pipe cleaners. They're really tiny. If you look at the size of some of these iliac arteries, for instance, here relative to the aorta, they're smaller. So there's an adaptation that's occurring, and it's because they chronically have lower flow down to the lower extremities. So we imaged with ultrasound about 300 patients from our the palate of VA, we noticed that these patients with spinal cord injury had a threefold increase of risk of aneurysms, very interesting by itself. But then the question is, what is the explanation for that? And that's still an ongoing investigation. But the point is that we think flow is influencing growth of aneurysms. This was a study that was done based on World War II amputees that showed that amputees had a higher risk of aneurysm growth, and you could actually predict which way the aneurysm would bow based upon which leg was amputated. So there seems to be some influence of flow on aneurysm growth. So we started a project 2 years ago now, funded by NIH, and it's a funding mechanism called the Specialized Center for Clinically Oriented Research, and it's kind of a multiple R01 type of project that are really protein in profiling of AAA and component of increasing flow through exercise, and then a simulation and imaging component, which is what I'm working on. And our hypothesis is that maybe by increasing flow with exercise, we could slow the growth of aneurysms in patients with small aneurysms. So that's ongoing. And the theory basically is that with standard theory, we have an increased clot burden, inflammation in the aneurysm, and we hope that this is what we'll show, but we don't know yet. whether that's going to be the case, because aneurysms grow pretty slowly, so it takes a while to do these types of studies. So our aims are to quantify the geometry, to measure blood flow during rest and dynamic exercise, and then simulate flow at rest and exercise. And this is the ones that we've imaged so far. These are all, by the way, small abdominal aortic aneurysm patients. These look remarkably different. They're all classified as small AAA patients with an aneurysm diameter less than 5 centimeters. But you look at, you know, the complexity, the geometric complexity, the variation in them, it really shows you why you have to do a large study to be able to ultimately maybe find groups of patients in different categories. So here's some of the, this is six of the patients where you have the geometry. We measure flow. And we get phase contrast data. We can assign that as an inflow boundary condition. We image these patients also during exercise. This is a bicycle we built for that purpose in an open MRI. So we have them ride a bicycle in the MRI and measure blood flow at rest, upright rest, and then upright exercise. And we then put that together to be able to describe, you know, exercise conditions. So for boundary conditions, we have an input flow. We can know how much flow is going down to the to lower extremities. We don't know about how flow divides the branches. It's just not possible to image that. The vessels are too small to get adequate resolution, so we have to make some assumptions. Like I said, we can measure brachial artery pressure and make an assumption that that's a pressure at the level of the diaphragm. And like I said, there's literature data supporting that. We're trying to use a simple model, a simple downstream boundary condition model. You know, every outlet has three parameters, and there are challenges, of course, with even trying to solve that problem and tune that. So here's just an example of flow at rest, and just to show you the differences, compute the inflow waveform, that's prescribed. Left renal flow, renal artery flow, that's computed, and that's about right, has high diastolic flow, that's characteristic of the renal arteries. Iliac flow shows a triphasic reverse flow, and then we see pressure waves, the pressure waves. This is still uniform properties. And here's a rest simulation, graded mild exercise and a more moderate level of exercise. I'll say a little bit more about the flow characteristics. Rest, this is a different patient, mild, and then more moderate exercise. I should say what we're doing for visualization is we're computing the speed, the velocity magnitude, and then we're volume rendering that, because if you want to see what's going on inside the aneurysm, you know, it, obviously if you look at the surface of the vessel, you're not going to be able to see what's going on. So there are different visualization techniques, and this is one that I like. And we can compute shear stress, time average shear stress, and other quantities, calculate a shear stress, and over groups of patients now to be able to look at the differences in how shear forces change. I mean, it's not obvious that if you go from rest to mild exercise, where at rest you have stagnation of flow and in pockets of very low shear, that you're going to change that during exercise conditions. It's not obvious, but you do have, with light exercise, pretty, you know, I'll show you some weak turbulence that actually really improves the mixing in the aneurysm and basically eliminate areas of low shear. So here's an important point about your discretization, proving mesh independence. This is why you have to be able to, you know, do very large scale computing. This is, the largest is a 26 million element mesh that we computed on in order to just understand when we got to the point of mesh independence. And then we'll typically, based on that, we'll back down to about 5 to 7 million elements or so. So what about, is the flow, if we, even though we have periodic input, is the flow periodic? And is that a signal of a transition from laminar to turbulent flow? So we can compute a turbulent kinetic energy. I think you might also call this an aperiodicity index. It's really the non-periodic component of the flow, but it's often called a turbulent intensity index. We can basically look at the fluctuating component compared to the periodic component and compute an energy. And this is a contour scalar map of this. This is actually during exercise conditions of the value of the turbulent kinetic energy. And you just see it's actually almost zero until you get into the aneurysm. And you can quantify those changes in the aneurysm geometry. We're not using a turbulence model. I mean, we're trying to resolve the scales here. I don't personally believe that the turbulence models that we have that are developed are appropriate for transitional flow, when others might have a different opinion. And this is rest and exercise conditions. And resting, so aneurysm flow under rest conditions, even with complex geometry, seems to be very little turbulence, still periodic flow, but that changes when we transition to exercise. Just some of the details on aneurysm hemodynamics. A point here is that just an analysis that we did to be able to understand the force that's acting on a stent graft that might explain this kind of migration or pushing this stent graft into the aneurysm. So fluid structure coupling. So first of all, the walls are obviously moving, they're deforming. They deform non-uniformly around the circumference. This highlights the reason or the importance of actually not just doing fluid structure coupling, but actually looking at the surrounding tissue as well, because that becomes quite important in these problems. This is an example of an MR study that we did where you track the motion of the aorta. These vectors are velocity vectors of a thoracic aorta of a pig. And then we basically did histology and showed that the wall was non-uniform in thickness around the circumference based upon the dynamics, directly correlating to the dynamics. So our vessels are not deforming uniformly circumferentially. And the wall, the vessel wall, is adapting to that, those changes. So for fluid structure interaction, the approach that we've taken is really inspired by Wormersley's elastic tube theory. I would say it's really just a generalization of that theory, and the idea is that we have a fluid domain, we write down our problems in the fluid, our governing equations in the fluid domain, write down elastodynamics equations, make the assumption of small displacements and linear properties, and introduce a fictitious body force in the solid domain, and then couple through the coupling of fictitious body force to attraction on the lateral surface of the fluid domain, incorporate elastodynamics into our fluid problem. And the idea here is that there are restrictions that are imposed when one does this. You know, right now it's linear elastic materials, infinitesimal deformation, and we have to assume that it's a membrane behavior. But the advantage of doing that is that when you do that, you can embed your, replace a term in your variational form with your elastodynamics equations here, and effectively embed your elastodynamics equations into your fluid calculation and solver, turn a fluid solver into a fluid structure solver very easily, actually. And the advantage of this is that it doesn't disrupt any of the parallelization strategies. The conditioning is affected to some degree, but doesn't seem to cause much of a problem. And then these are basically changes in the momentum, continuity, residuals, and then the stiffness matrix. So relatively minor changes, and you can get I call it a poor man's fluid structure interaction. But anyways, it's better than rigid wall theory. Some of the details on a solution strategy. Here's just an example now of a flow. This is of a size of a vessel, the size of a coarctation, and the size of a human aorta, and where we have a stenosis and a prescribed flow waveform, which is physiologically realistic. And you see, the turbulence coming through, the turbulent jet coming through this restriction, and you see the wall dynamics that are induced as a result of that, and then the pressure field as well. So we're using, appropriate outflow boundary conditions, of course, here. So here's an actual patient case of aortic coarctation, and again, you see the flow. In this case, actually, we measured the amount of flow that was going down, so we could impose those as boundary conditions, and you see the dynamics of the vessel. We don't have any external tissue support in this model, so that's, one of the, it's not going to move around so much in vivo, but definitely those same forces that are causing this type of vibratory motion are going to be there. And that's an explanation why many times in these patients, this downstream of the aortic coarctation, you have post-stenotic dilatation, enlargement of the aorta downstream.
Is there any longitudinal motion?
We're not fixing longitudinal motion in this case. We're not prescribing it, and that's an excellent question. And at the end of the talk, I'll come back to this point about why we need to get information about how the vasculature is tethered and supported for to these calculations, yeah.
It seems like it's thinned down at the end.
Yes, it is, yes, that's right. So we have to fix it somewhere. But we're holding it here at every one of the outlets here, and that's another important point, is that what are the appropriate degrees of tissue support? I know John Frederick has really thought a lot about these issues for his work too. The cerebral aneurysm model of fluid structure coupling, et cetera. I want to close with one point that I think we've just kind of run into this point, and it posed a lot of challenges for us. There were a certain class of problems that we weren't able to solve until we fixed this problem. And the issue is that when we have geometric complexity, flow complexity, approaching outlet boundaries, or in some cases where we actually have reverse flow at outlet boundaries. And we see this in the thoracic aorta. When we image patients, you actually see an early diastole, you see a short period of retrograde flow. The inertia of blood is carrying it down the aorta, it's basically sucking it back in from the branch vessels in early diastole. So this is measured, we see this type of data, but it's a problem in a boundary condition that was an outlet boundary condition that becomes an inlet boundary condition. It's an interesting challenge. So what we decided to do is to actually, the challenge that we have is that we're enforcing our relationship at the boundary weekly. The relationship between pressure and flow enforced in an integral sense. So we're not controlling pressure or flow. And our solution to that was actually, sounds like maybe a similar solution to the problems that you were talking about, Alessandro. Our solution to that was to be able to actually constrain not the velocity, but the shape of the velocity profile. Use an augmented Lagrangian method to actually do that, to enforce the shape of the velocity profile. So flow rate is derived naturally using the boundary condition, but we control the shape now. And so we can use our couple multi-domain method, new fluid structure interaction, and then enforce, add an extra term using an augmented Lagrangian method to be able to enforce a constraint. And the question is that how much upstream is that constraint felt? Here's a simple problem of a single tube where we're imposing an outlet constraint, where we have an inlet Dirichlet boundary condition here, velocity, prescribed velocity, and a constraint on the shape of the outlet velocity. And the differences in, for instance, shear stress are very local, right near the outlet, and oscillatory shear, very local. Here's the difference between them. So that was encouraging to see that, and we've also done studies in abdominal aortic aneurysms and other problems to see, first of all, how far could we truncate the boundary? How close to the domain could we truncate it? And when you, even though you're going to obviously introduce, error and uncertainties close to the outlet boundary, if you're mainly interested in, for instance, in flow in the aorta, then you're not concerned about that. So we could then solve flow, for instance, fluid structure coupling through the thoracic aorta, pressure, wall displacement, and velocity, where you are getting reverse flow at the boundaries. That actually solved a lot of problems in other areas as well. Here's an example now of a solution. It's an image-based model from CT. We actually have an anisotropic adaptive mesh generation. Wing-Kessel outlet boundary conditions at all the outlets. The augmented Lagrangian enforcement of constraints, fluid structure interaction, and then also spatially varying tissue properties as well. I think one of the advantages of this method, of this fluid structure method, is that it's very fast, it's very scalable, and even though we don't, we're not incorporating large displacements, it's not an ALE method, we can do things like incorporate tissue support, like incorporate spatially varying properties, and start to investigate other problems in the circulation. There are some advantages, I think, to this type of approach. Last example is a coronary flow problem. And the challenge here is that we have flow through our epicardial, our surface vessels, depends on aortic pressure and our downstream boundary conditions. The aortic pressure depends upon left ventricular flow and pressure conditions of the systemic circulation. And our outflow boundary conditions for the epicardial vessels depend upon a time-varying intermyocardial pressure. So the approach that we've taken, that others have taken as well, is to be able to couple a lump parameter heart model at the inlet, a lump parameter coronary model where you have a time-varying left ventricular pressure, and then Winkessel models for all the other outlets. And then simulate flow in this patient with a triple bypass at rest and then during exercise conditions. This is a simulation done with a rigid wall approximation. We've since done these with deformable wall as well. Deformable wall, but we're not doing large displacements of the coronary arteries, of course. And then the flow, aortic pressure, left ventricular pressure, everything is at rest, exercise, is all computed naturally through the interaction of the heart model and the vascular model. And here's flow with the bypass at rest and then exercise conditions. And we can compute how flow changes, for instance, in this patient with the triple bypass and how that flow might change with rest and also exercise conditions. So I want to just close this point about verification and validation. I like this quote, no one believes the CFD results except the one who performed the calculation. Everyone believes the experimental results except the one who performed the experiment. So that's very true. For a verification, there are some things that one can do, and even with fluid structure coupling, with Wormsley's elastic tube theory, for example. And Dr. Zamir has a wonderful chapter in his book with the derivation of this theory. And we just did a study comparing the analytic solution to our numerical result, and we were very gratified to see we nailed the analytical solution. And of course, the bigger challenges are with validation. And in different circumstances, we've done some validation work comparing flow measurements, CFD to MRI measurements, and this work is published. Mm-hmm. And then some in vivo validation work that we've done in pigs. So some challenges, geometry, boundary conditions we talked about, fluid mechanical phenomena, in many cases transitional flow, very complex solid mechanics phenomena, varying tissue properties, especially varying anisotropy, the vessels adapt, their active component. I think, we need to first of all try to match our measurable data, which in our measurable data is flow distribution and pressure. So if we're going to, before we go into the more complex phenomena, we have to be able to do the basic stuff first. I think flow, shear, and pressure are all important for predicting outcomes of interventions. If we want to then go forward and try to think about how vessels adapt, we need to include wall tensile stress as well as shear stress. If we're going to get the wall dynamics right, we got to get the pressure right. If we want to get the pressure right, we have to treat the boundary conditions right. And in many cases, there are simulations that are done where it's quite common assigning zero pressure or prescribed outflow pressure waveforms. And I think it's not appropriate to do that for fluid structure interaction simulations particularly. This is a paper that's now been submitted on coupling our fluid-solid interaction techniques with Jay Humphrey's growth and remodeling code. So we're starting to basically evolve geometry. There's a rate of mass production term, which depends upon tensile stress and shear stress. And there's a lot to this. I don't really have time to go into today, but I can refer you to the paper, where we're then starting to basically evolve geometry, solving the fluid structure problem over the cardiac cycle and starting to evolve geometry. Another challenge is getting experimental data suitable for initializing and validating simulations. We can get cardiac-gated CT data to quantify deformation and strain, and I think it's interesting to think about how to use that to infer information about tissue properties and external tissue support. This is just an example in thoracic aorta where we're looking at the particular cross-section of the thoracic aorta over the cardiac cycle to see how it deforms. And here, actually looking at longitudinal strain and looking at the longitudinal motion. The thoracic aorta, the longitudinal deformation strain is about one-third that of the circumferential, so a few percent in the subjects that we've imaged. So it's very small. There is definitely significant longitudinal support and tethering, and the nature of that, I think, is quite interesting. But these are things that have to be incorporated. So this is members of my lab. I've highlighted in green some of the people that have really particularly utilized the work. Alberto Figueroa's research staff did fluid structure coupling. I should say my alumni, Irene Vignon-Clementel, did the outflow boundary condition work. Jin Kim has done the augmented Lagrangian approach. Sean Shadden has done turbulent intensity work and also using Lagrangian coherent structures to describe flow phenomena. And some of my collaborators at Stanford, some other institutions, some funding support from different sources, NSF, NIH, and other sources, and picture Stanford. So.